Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Killer Astrology. I'm your host, Laura, and today, November 22nd, 2020, is day two of Sagittarius season. The sun just moved from Scorpio, the mysterious and brooding sign of the scorpion, and into Sagittarius, the adventurous and enthusiastic sign of the archer. Whenever the sun moves into a new sign, it's an opportunity to integrate more of that sign's qualities into your life or into your personality. When the sun moves into Aries, for example, you might ask yourself, how can you be more assertive, or how can you get more excited about starting new projects? With the sun moving into Sagittarius, now's the time to ask yourself, where in my life am I playing things too safe, and how can I take more calculated risks? How can I seek out more excitement, or how can I communicate more honestly? Sagittarius is ruled by Jupiter, the planet of growth and expansion. So if you're already a risk taker and a freedom seeker, this may actually be a good time for you to cultivate some awareness to make sure that you don't go overboard. You should still allow yourself to have fun, but try not to get too carried away. Speaking of Sagittarius, we have a special guest today who happens to be a Sagittarius, Alan Austin. Alan is the host of his own YouTube series, The Alan Austin Show, where he talks about all things sports. Since today's episode is on a former professional athlete, Alan is here to draw on his sports knowledge to add to the details of this case. It's a tragic story, the story of Jovan Belcher, the NFL star who fatally shot his girlfriend in 2012 before turning the gun on himself. We'll talk about the details of this story and also talk about some of the nuances of professional athlete life that may have driven Jovan to this place. Then, of course, we'll talk about the astrology. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for having me.
No problem. It's good to have you. So you are Alan Austin from The Alan Austin Show. Would you just tell everybody what you do and a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I currently go to grad school at Iona College, where I am going for a degree in sports communication and media, basically sports broadcasting. And The Alan Austin Show is a late night talk show style sports show, which I don't think there are many of, if any, besides mine. I also have a podcast with my friend Ben, where we talk about movies with American in the title. So amongst all that, I do want to be in the media world, and being on your podcast seems like an opportunity I couldn't miss.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to have you. And I'm curious. So you mentioned your podcast about movies with American in the name. Could you give a little background into that? I'm very curious.
Sure. So a friend of mine for years has been saying that something will put American in the title to suddenly seem more important. And then another friend of mine was like, you know, all these American movies, are they actually American? Are they actually, you know, representing American values and ideas? So we decided to put that concept into a podcast. So we'll watch a movie with American in the title and then discuss its ideas, its cultural impact, and how it relates to the American theme. So far we've done American Pie, American Psycho, American President, and we're going to do every American film regardless of its importance or popularity.
So that's awesome. Tell us about The Alan Austin Show.
Like I said, it's a late night style talk show centered around sports. So we do a monologue, we do a comedy segment, and we have an interview with a guest who is in the sports world to some capacity. So it's still very early in its progression and development, but it's something I'm going to keep doing because I just love doing it.
Awesome. Yeah, I love your show. I think it's hilarious, but I also know you, and I happen to think you're one of the most, I think you're one of the funniest people I know.
Thank you.
So before we get into our story today, we're talking about Jovan Belcher. I just want to tell everybody a little bit about your astrology. I'm not going to go into any analysis on you, don't worry. But you are a Sagittarius sun, you have a Sagittarius ascendant, and you also have a Gemini moon. So you are, I guess I will do a tiny bit of analysis and say that learning is a big part of who you are in your life. And it's no surprise that you found yourself in this place where you're disseminating information. So I'm happy to have you and to use that skill of yours here.
Very interesting. I'm still trying to figure out all the astrology stuff after listening to your show, but it's very, very cool and intricate.
It's definitely intricate. There's a lot to learn. I think you can learn about it forever. I definitely am learning. Every time I do an episode, I'm learning more and more. So it's definitely a lot to learn. But I'm glad that you are intrigued by it. So let's get into our episode today. So we'll give you a little bit of a background on Jovan Belcher's story, and then we'll have some conversation about, honestly, Alan, we're going to use your sports knowledge to talk about some of the things that were going on. Did he stand out against other football players, against other sports athletes? If so, how? And we'll talk a little bit about maybe some physical stuff that could have influenced him. And we'll kind of get to the bottom of whether there was some physical stuff influencing this.
Okay, sounds great.
Awesome. So Jovan Belcher was born in West Babylon, New York, which is on Long Island. He was born on July 24th, 1987. He has three older sisters, and he was very, very close with his family, very close with his mother. And probably some of that is because he was estranged from his father, who didn't live with them while he was growing up. But he did play football his entire life. He had this close family unit. He would go to school. He played football. He was also a star wrestler for his high school. And some friends have described him, or at least one friend has described him, as a hard worker who will never back down from a challenge, which is very interesting. And we'll talk about that more when we go to his astrology. So, Alan, would you talk a little bit about his career? What happened after he went to high school?
So after high school, he went to the University of Maine, which is not necessarily known as like a football powerhouse school. So right off the bat, he had to continually prove himself. And when he got to the NFL and played for the Kansas City Chiefs, his coaches would be on his, you know, on his butt, so to speak, just constantly pressuring him, constantly threatening his job, constantly making him prove himself because he only came from a school like the University of Maine, as opposed to some of the big football schools that produce a lot of NFL talent. So he was a guy who always had a chip on his shoulder, always had something to prove, and there was a lot of pressure on him at all times. Statistically, he had a pretty average, nothing to write home about career. He played from 09 to 2012, and he played linebacker. So what you're looking at with linebacker are the number of tackles he had, the number of fumbles he caused or sacks, and he didn't really have a lot. I would say the crowning achievement of his career was having a pretty good playoff game in a loss, but he had 1.5 sacks, 11 total tackles, 2 tackles for loss, and 2 QB hits. So to put that in layman's terms,
thank you.
Yes, he had a pretty good playoff game, but his career as a whole was nothing really to write home about statistically. But there are tales of his work ethic. He was always, you know, busting his tail to make the play, to get involved. And that led to a lot of hard hits. That led to a lot of marks on his helmet, so to speak, where his head was being used as the tackling device or one of the methods to getting his opponents to the ground for sure and often.
Mm-hmm. When you're a linebacker, are you mostly in an offensive position? So you're doing the hits. You're not necessarily protecting the ball or your team. You're going out and trying to tackle other people.
Yes. It's funny you worded it because he's on the offensive, but it's a defensive position. So he's on the hunt to get the person with the ball. And usually that means someone's charging at you full speed and you have to take him down. So it leads to a lot of high impact collisions.
Got it. That's fascinating. It's fascinating because of what I've seen in his chart. And I'll just do a little bit of assessment now that he has lots of factors in his astrology chart that speak to this fight. You know, his position is to fight against people. And he has this theme in his chart of fighting for himself, fighting for his team. It's just so apparent. And so to hear your description of his position, it's just really interesting how that's played out into his career and into his life.
Wow. And you say fighting for himself, which, like I said before, he's had to do or had to do his entire career, had to keep proving himself, had to keep earning his spot on the team.
Mm-hmm. And he wasn't going to back down from that. I mean, like his friend said, hard worker who never backs down from a challenge. It's very clear that he does not back down. He's not a quitter. He has so much drive and he's going to push until he gets what he wants.
Right. Having said all that, he still felt a ton of pressure. It started to wear him down quite a bit before he tragically left this earth and took his girlfriend, with him. I don't want to jump ahead, but yes.
No, that's fine. I mean, we'll get there for sure. I'm just curious, do you know how he got signed? Because I know he was a free agent after he graduated from the University of Maine. And then he, of course, was signed to the Kansas City Chiefs. But do you know how long it took for him to get signed? Or if there's any other additional facts about that process?
So he was not drafted. That happens often, where teams will sign undrafted free agents. He went undrafted in the 2009 draft, and he was later signed by the Chiefs for 2010. So it would be the season after he should have been drafted, he began his NFL career.
Got it. That must have been hard for him. He must have been working really hard in that span of time, however many months it was, to get himself noticed.
For sure.
Yeah, so he has this history of fighting to earn his keep, to earn his place. He also had this relationship with his girlfriend, Cassandra Perkins, who was from Texas, and she was the cousin of a teammate of his. So they had been introduced through this teammate, and then she actually wound up moving to Missouri. The Kansas City Chiefs are based in Kansas City, Missouri. And so she moved to be with him in 2010. So it must have been right after he started playing. And then they dated for a couple of years. And in 2012, they had a daughter named Zoe. So she was only about 3 months old when on December 1st, 2012, he shot Cassandra 9 times in their master bathroom. And while this was going on, his mother was in another room taking care of the baby. And she heard, of course, she heard the gunshots. And then he walked downstairs, walked past his mother, who was holding the baby. I can't imagine what was going through her mind as she stood there. And he kissed the baby on the head, said sorry, and walked out. After that, he drove to Arrowhead Stadium, which is where the Chiefs practice. So Romeo Crennel is the head coach of the Chiefs. He requested a meeting with him. And then he also had Scott Pioli, who was the general manager of the team, who came out. He was in the parking lot at this time. So he must have requested the meeting from the parking lot. They came out to come see him, of course, standing there with a gun. And they were trying to talk him down, but it was to no avail, and he wound up shooting himself in the head in front of them. And what's interesting is that when he got there, at the time this was happening, he had a blood alcohol level of a 0.17, which is a little over double the legal limit. So he was pretty drunk when this was happening.
Yes. On the peripherals, it should be known that he had a history of drinking once his career started. And a lot of NFL players will use alcohol to numb the physical pain they feel daily. But for sure, him with Belcher, he used it often. And it's well documented that he kind of became reliant on alcohol to numb the pain he was constantly feeling. He also had a turbulent relationship with Cassandra Perkins. They would fight often. And he even had a girlfriend on the side that he was, in fact, out with the night before the tragic incident. And there are some stories that say that he even had said to her that he would shoot Perkins if she continued to, I guess, interfere in his life, so to speak. I can't say for sure what was said in these messages. I can only report what some reports are saying. So, yeah. Belcher was introduced to Cassandra by the wife of a player who was her first cousin. So the player was not her first cousin. The wife of Jamal Charles, who was a big-time running back on the Chiefs at the time, was cousins with Cassandra.
Got it. Thank you. And that probably speaks to some of the relationships that he had with others on the team. I mean, he was friendly with people, friendly enough for them to be introducing him to potential girlfriends.
Yeah.
So he was a pretty well-liked guy before all of this happened. And even at his funeral, I mean, people were saying wonderful things about him. And it's hard because here you have this kind of situation. It's not like he is, you know, somebody like a Ted Bundy who's been a serial killer and known to be very violent for years. I mean, this was clearly to the outside world, this was a single incident that was completely, hugely tragic. And so people were dealing with the loss of their friend. They were dealing with the loss of their sister, daughter, cousin. They were dealing with all of this loss. And at the same time, people were thinking, how could this have happened? What was going on? Why was this such a crazy, intense freak incident that ended in this horrific tragedy?
Yeah. And there's a couple things I think are at play here. Yes, he was well-liked. Yes, he had a lot of friends, and yes, he was pretty successful. At one point, he was making over $1 million a season. However, he constantly felt the pressure, and I don't know about you, but so much pressure to constantly be better than the level you're already at takes its toll. Mm-hmm. You mix that with, you know, the use of alcohol, and you mix that with what I think is the biggest component to all of this, and that's being an NFL player and the amount of head injuries that go along with that.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, give you a few stats, between 1.7 and 3 million sports and recreation concussions happen each year. 300,000 of those are football related, and 5 of 10 go unreported. So while
that's 50%, I mean, that's half.
Right.
That's half of the injuries. That's crazy.
Yes. So you take that into consideration with the fact that if you're an NFL player who's constantly fighting to prove himself and earn his spot, you are not going to tell the coaching staff or the medical staff that you are feeling it every time you get knocked around. So you're right. going to go back in the game and you're going to take hit after hit. And concussions in the NFL is, you know, no secret. There's been a lot of studies on CTE. There's been movies about it. The movie Concussion starring Will Smith really dives into how all this knowledge of sports-related concussions, football specifically, came about. So mm-hmm. you're talking about guys who are hitting their head helmet to helmet like two rams fighting in the wild several times over one game, not to mention practice, not to mention how many games there are a year. There are constant repeated blows to the head that do alter a person's life. There's no mm-hmm. doubt about it.
Yeah. And it's interesting because when you, there are certain things that happen to us that we don't see or that are minor. So if you think about, you walk into your bathroom and you stub your toe, you hurt your toe and it hurts like all hell for, you know, 5 minutes. And then the next day it's like it never happened. But if you keep hitting your toe in the same spot, eventually, you know, your toenail will fall off or something will happen where you're going to see the lasting result. And so if you think about the force that these men are using, I mean, these are men who weigh like 300 pounds and they're running at each other full force. And that's a big impact. And so even if it's not in that moment, if the injury isn't big enough to cause some kind of visible effect, over time, all of those little hits are going to add up into something bigger.
Yeah.
And this is happening to so many athletes.
For sure. And the final game of his career, just a couple days prior, actually, it was November 18th, and the tragedy took place on December 1st.
Mm-hmm.
November 18th was his last game, and there was a noticeable tackle he made where when he got up, he was shaking his head and he had to take a moment to, you know, collect himself, and then went right back into the game. So mm-hmm. something was off from that moment and it was pretty evident. But in the game of football, this gets overlooked because it happens all the time.
Right. So how often are there violence issues related to CTE or related to head hits? Because this is common enough that it's become a topic of conversation in the sports world because there are so many domestic violence issues or just violence issues. You know, you hear about an athlete who goes out to a bar and winds up hitting the bouncer or hitting somebody in the face. And this is pretty common. And we could argue that part of it is because they're just playing a violent sport. And you could argue that something else is that these changes in their brain create this tendency to be violent towards other people.
For sure. I mean, there are many famous examples of NFL players who had extreme CTE, which is chronic traumatic, and I'm going to botch the pronunciation of this, so I apologize, encephalopathy. So
I think it's encephalopathy. Yeah.
Encephalopathy. It sounds like a Sesame Street word. Encephalopathy. You got it. So you take CTE and you look at some more famous examples. You've got Aaron Hernandez, who committed mm-hmm. murder and was a very, very twisted individual. I know it's unfair to say that, but looking back, he knew what he was doing a lot of the time, but he had severe CTE. You had O.J. Simpson with worries that he had CTE over the years, and that was prior to when it was really known what it was. But you look back at his career, and he was a running back who took a lot of hits, and we all know what he was accused of. There mm-hmm. were rumors of CTE being involved. You had Chris Benoit, who was a professional wrestler, who had such severe CTE, the doctors said his brain looked like that of an 80-something-year-old man, and he took his own life as well as his wife and his sons. So there are extreme bouts of violence with CTE, and it affects everyone differently. But if he did have CTE, it's safe to say there may have been a tendency for violence for sure, regardless of mm-hmm. how he lived his life prior to that point.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's hard from an astrology perspective, I'm guessing now, I haven't done a lot of charts on athletes, to be honest, but just looking at this one chart and a couple here and there, it's clear that there are underlying elements of this fighting spirit, which you need in order to be a successful athlete. Even if you're playing baseball, you have to have that drive to win. You have to have this competitive nature and something that's going to push you to push your body to these limits that most people don't even want to push them to mm-hmm. or can't for some reason. So the same planets and the same forces that create this intense drive are also linked to violence in some way. So, and the way that they relate where they create this powerful person, another element of those same relationships is violence. So you could probably say, I'm not saying this as a blanket statement, but it's one hypothesis, is that athletes based on astrology specifically might be more capable of violence anyway. But if you think about brain hits, you're talking about judgment. If you hit your brain so many times, or if you're super drunk, your judgment is going to be impaired. And there's probably factors, whether it's education, whether it's parenting or having good examples, you're learning to keep these impulses under check in certain areas of your life. And if you hit your brain too many times and you lack judgment, you're going to stopping yourself from doing these things in situations where you shouldn't.
Right. And just to touch on your point about domestic violence and abuse, and this is just purely speculation in a psychological manner, I guess, or from a psychological standpoint. But if you're a football player, if you're an athlete of any kind, you're constantly needing to prove yourself over other men. That mm-hmm. leads to competition, that leads to, you know, the alpha complex, where you might be in a room where you're not the alpha, where you're not the guy and you want to be. So you translate that into your home life, where you can suddenly be that after spending all your workday not being that. Does that make any sense?
Totally. Absolutely. Because you're faced with all of, not only are you trying to prove yourself, but at the same time, you're constantly being told, well, someone's doing this better than you, and you're not trying hard enough. And when you get home, it's a transition period. You're going from this intense environment, you're going home, and there's going to be some parts of that that stick with you. When you get home from a really long, hard day at work, you don't just snap out of it and become totally calm. There's things you have to do to bring yourself down to a level where you can rest for the night. And who knows what he needed to be able to do that, or what any athlete needs to be able to do that. But it's hard to transition from this very masculine, this very intense, I keep using the word intense, but this very intensely competitive environment to come home, where you don't need that competition at home, but some of it's going to stick with you. And like you said, there were arguments that were happening between him and Cassandra. There were, and it's interesting that you said that he only made about $1 million a year. I had no idea what to expect in terms of his salary, because some of these players are making $50 million a year. But he was, like you mentioned, he was a free agent. He didn't go to this crazy school. He was pretty average. So he wasn't going to be one of those players that was making so much money. And one of the things that they talked about that I've seen in sources is that they were fighting over finances, which makes sense. Talk about competition. You're on this team with people who are making $50 million a year, or whatever it is, and you're only making $1 million a year. So how do you keep up with these people who can keep spending?
Right. And he only made $1 million later on, towards one of the, if not the last year of his career. And he spent $122,000 of that on a Bentley. So he was someone who didn't have the money that other players did, and maybe they were struggling over finances because of reckless spending, going out all the time and stuff like that. So, mm-hmm. but that's more of like, that's pretty common, wouldn't you say, yeah. amongst most relationships is arguments over stuff like that. But I think the fact that he had a girl on the side and stuff, he probably had so much pent up nervousness, so much pent up aggression, so much pent up just wanting to be comfortable in his own skin. Yeah. And he never could be, even with the people closest to him.
Yeah. And one of the things that they did fight about was also his side relationships. I don't know for sure, but I don't think he just had one. I think this was a common theme in their relationship, but she was his, you know, the girlfriend everybody knew. She was the longtime girlfriend. They had a kid together. He's a football player. How do you leave in that situation? I don't know if she wanted to leave, but it's tough because you can, if someone cheats on you, some people have a really hard limit. Like, okay, you cheated on me. I'm going to go. I'm not going to sit here and stay with you.
Right.
But there's so many other factors playing in. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to make that decision, especially if you have a kid with somebody.
Yeah. And a lot of times in these murder suicide situations, you'll see that they don't just kill one person. And right. I think it's important to note that his daughter survived the tragedy.
Yes. Thank you. I wanted to ask you that. Why do you think that he did not kill his daughter?
I honestly, and obviously we can't prove this, this is all speculation, but my guess is that he did not kill his daughter because he had no animosity towards his daughter. Mm. It sounds like he had a ton of animosity towards Cassandra. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it be brain injury, whether it be just a fit of uncontrollable temper, he killed her because she was the one who he felt was giving his life a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. And his little daughter, I don't think he associated her with that. And then mm-hmm. he killed himself from the guilt, it seems, of killing Cassandra and knowing there would be a life of prison. There would be mm-hmm. a life ahead of him that he did not want to live. So from the moment he shot her, it was probably pretty evident to him that A, his daughter wouldn't have her mother. His football career was over. He would spend a life in jail, and he needed to kind of solve that problem, and he took his own life. That's all speculation, but that's what I gather from everything I've read about him. And the fact that he didn't kill his daughter lines up with the fact that he did have, you know, some good qualities. I know it's so odd to put it that way, but to be selective in just killing his girlfriend meant that it sounds like more of a personal vendetta against her in his eyes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I definitely think, and the night before they had both gone out separately. She was drinking, he was drinking. Probably some of this high blood alcohol level was left over from the night before because this happened in the morning. So I think that there was also this anger that she was doing her own thing and he couldn't control that. And I'll get more into that when I talk about the astrology, but I think there was this aspect of control that was really hard for him to let go. And she probably, I mean, I don't know, again, speculation, but she probably said something to him about how he was with another woman. Because as you mentioned before, I think you mentioned that he was out with another woman the night before. He wasn't just out.
Right. And, you know, part of the, we can't know for sure, but he might have had the high blood alcohol because it might have been premeditated that morning.
You know, I was thinking about that, and I was asking myself, was it premeditated? Was it not? And I tend to think it actually wasn't. And the reason for that is astrological, but I'll get into that later. But I think back to the question that I asked you, I think that another reason he didn't hurt his daughter was because he was so close to his mother. He would, in some accounts that I read, people would talk about how when his mother came to a game unexpectedly, he was so thrilled. It was like the only, it made him so happy. He had this really strong relationship with her throughout his life. And she was there on that day and she was holding the baby when he left. So I think he could not have killed his mother. I just don't think he ever would have done that. And I think her being there might have saved the baby. I don't think that he necessarily would have killed his daughter. I think I tend to agree with you, but I'm just saying, I think this is another factor that was protective of her.
Gotcha. And I forgot to mention this before, but he was also heavily reliant on large doses of pain medication towards the end of his life to deal with the pain as well.
Got it. For the physical pain.
Yes.
Wow. So this kind of stuff, I would love to say that it doesn't happen and it, you know, it would never happen again, but it seems like based on all of the factors, cultural, you know, we talked about this competition and trying to be like all the other guys. And then there's also the physical of being hurt constantly and having your judgment impaired because of these injuries. What do you think? And I feel like this is probably a question that's asked pretty frequently, but in your opinion, what do you think is the way to help prevent things like this? If we're thinking about the NFL, what things can the NFL do? Or even what things can coaches do as when kids are playing sports? When kids are playing sports growing up, what can coaches do? What messages can coaches give to help them be more prepared for life as an athlete?
Right. Couple things based on the questions you just asked. One, the NFL has already started to make changes to their rules to protect players. Head-to-head contact will result in a penalty or fines or ejection from the game if it's too ruthless. They are trying to protect players the best they can while still, you know, playing football. On the youth side, I've seen a lot of leagues up until high school only play flag football, so that they're not repeatedly hitting their head while they're still in middle school and younger. Mm-hmm. So there are little things that are happening, but to mention, to make a point about what you said about life after football, it's really up to coaches to help, you know, teach their players more than just football, to teach them how to be better athletes, better humans, and tell them that it's almost like a guidance counselor. A good coach is like a guidance counselor. They take you under their wing. They're a, most times a father figure, but it also could be a motherly figure on the girl's side of stuff. And it's really up to a good coach to help teach life lessons and not just X's and O's of sports.
Yeah,
you know, it's a lot on parents too. A lot of parents, you know, are very hard on children to be very good at sports and to work extra hard. And there's a lot of pressure. And Javon Belcher faced a lot of pressure. So I'm not saying if you pressure your child, it's going to lead them to murder, but there should be in sports a remembering that it's supposed to be for fun.
Yeah.
And I know even at the NFL level, you're getting paid a lot of money and it's very serious, but the reason you start playing sports and remain and continue to play sports should be because you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
The average lifespan of an NFL career is something like 3.5 years. There's really not a lot. And it's a fleeting stardom, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes of fame in theory. Mm-hmm. And these guys take all these blows to the head, and then they're left afterwards trying to put the pieces together to the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Belcher was known to skip thoughts towards the end of his life in regular conversation with teammates, where he would forget what he was saying or he would not finish what he was saying. And it became noticeable. And I do think that CTE, I don't think an autopsy was ever done on his brain, but I'm sure it would be a brain that was quite affected by football.
Yeah, they actually did do an autopsy on him.
Oh, okay.
And I think it was apparent that he had brain injuries for sure. So, I mean, everything that you're saying applies. And I love what you said about coaches being guidance counselors. I think that's such a great analogy. And if you think about the most motivating sports movies, like if you think about Remember the Titans, those coaches are teaching life lessons. They're right. Not just pushing their athletes to be the best, even though, of course, they want them to be. They also have this understanding that losing is a lesson. And so kind of creating that culture in real life is super important. And I think with this kind of contact sport, you're never going to totally get rid of the risk of this type of injury. I mean, it's part of it, but having the knowledge of what it means and being able to help players calm, like teaching them skills to calm themselves down and teaching them some of the opposite messages to competition is super important. One thing I want to note, because you were talking about life lessons, is that actually before this horrific incident happened, he was actually receiving counseling that the Kansas City Chiefs were paying for. I don't know if it was a resident counselor for the team, but he was receiving counseling. It could be that, I don't know how long he saw a counselor. I don't know, of course, what they talked about, but if this was short term, it could have just been too little too late if it was too recent and mm-hmm. it just wasn't, you know, and also alcohol and drug abuse is involved. So I think that complicates things a little bit.
But for sure. Counseling helps, but it's not a Band-Aid that stays on.
It right. needs
to be something that is constant. And just because you go doesn't mean you're getting what you should out of it.
Totally, because you only get out what you put in.
Right, right. And, you know, if you're going to your counselor and disagreeing with everything they say or writing it off or, and there's an opposite where I think is a negative way to counsel, and that's you kind of tell your patient that everything they're saying is right or everything they're saying mm-hmm. is justified. I think counseling has to be very specific to the patient and not just totally. A general way to counsel, if that makes any sense.
Well, as a counselor, I get what you're saying. And I agree with that 100%. I mean, you need to be giving people feedback. Otherwise, what's the point? They're never going to improve or meet their goals. So, and it's hard. Some people might not know what they want, or they might have clouded judgment about what they want. Like he very, and again, speculation, but he very well could have gone to counseling and just talked about how he wanted to be the best. You don't, as a counselor, I only know what people are struggling with if they tell me. And so if he wasn't doing that, of course it affected his treatment.
Right.
Well, thank you, Alan. This was a great conversation. I would love if you could tell everybody again, your podcast, your show, where they can find you, social media.
Sure. On Twitter, it's at Alan, A-L-L-E-N, underscore Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N, underscore. And on Instagram, it's Alan Austin Sports. So at Alan Austin Sports. And the American Scene podcast is the podcast I referenced earlier, and it's spelled S-C-E-N-E. So American Scene. And yeah, the Alan Austin Show's on YouTube. Just Google, just search the Alan Austin Show.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Alan. It was great to have you, and we'd love to have you back sometime. So
appreciate it.
Special thanks to Alan for sharing his knowledge with us today. Make sure to check out Alan's YouTube series, The Alan Austin Show, and listen to his podcast, American Scene, on Apple, Spotify, Google, or Anchor. Now let's move to our astrology segment. Jovan Belcher was born on July 24, 1987, in West Babylon, New York. He has an early degree Leo sun, just like our friend Luca Magnotta, although we really can't compare him to Luca, who's on just a completely different level in terms of narcissism and just being a plain sociopath. Jovan Belcher was clearly not a sociopath, and I say that because he had a Cancer moon. The Cancer moon is pretty synonymous with feeling very strong emotions and having lots of empathy, which are qualities that sociopaths just don't possess, or at least possess at very low levels. Jovan's Cancer moon also speaks to the relationship that he had with his mother. We know they were very close. With the moon in Cancer, you have somebody who has a mother who's kind of the stereotypical image of what a mother should be. Someone who's caring and nurturing, who keeps you well-fed, who protects you. That's probably the mother that Jovan had, someone who was very caring and attentive to his needs. And we see that in the placement of his moon. In addition to having a Cancer moon, Jovan also had a Cancer Mercury and a Cancer Venus. So he was really a very emotional and caring guy. This was a gift in many ways, but probably one that was hard to reconcile in his environment. Alan and I were talking earlier about the culture of a football team being filled with competition and an all-around masculine energy. I can't say for sure what Jovan's experience was being within that setting, but this aspect of himself, this emotional aspect of himself, may very well have been hidden away behind layers of the other qualities that he might have showcased to better fit in with the crowd. What are those other qualities? Well, as we mentioned earlier, Jovan was a go-getter, a fighter. He was determined to make a place for himself, and that shows in his birth chart through quite a few aspects, actually. The first I'll mention is his early degree Leo Sun trine to his Aries North Node. This aspect is about goals, since each point represents personal goals and the personal mission slightly differently in the birth chart. The Sun represents what I'll refer to as your personality goals. Who do you want to be in this lifetime? What type of person are all your experiences and all your actions creating? The answer is given by looking at your Sun sign. With the Sun in Leo, Jovan was building a sense of self-assuredness and the ability to put his talents on display. And this mission was very easily facilitated through a trine aspect with Jovan's North Node. The North Node, like the Sun, is about goals, but while the Sun is about the type of person you're becoming, the North Node is about what you're meant to accomplish or attain. With his North Node in Aries, Jovan was meant to conquer. Well, you might say, conquer what exactly? Well, we don't exactly know because we'd need his birth time to place the North Node in a house. But we know that he's meant to fight for what he wants, which fosters a sense of self-sufficiency and creates a sense of being capable, feeling capable of going out in a new direction. Aries is a fearless warrior, remember, who goes into battle to exert his force and to win the fight. So putting these two things together, the egoic desire of his Leo Sun to be seen as a talented athlete, and the drive from his Aries North Node to conquer whatever he sets out to do, we see a very, very determined individual. And this determination is deepened by another aspect, a square to the Sun by Pluto. Pluto is an endless well of power, sometimes destructive, yes, but nevertheless intensely powerful. It can be used as fuel, burning endlessly to get closer to possessing what it desires. Jovan actually had Pluto square both his Sun and Mars, so he could use this force to build the version of himself that he hoped to display to the world through the Sun, and also to assert his dominance and win battles that his Mars encountered. These abilities to persevere and conquer undoubtedly made him a very incredible athlete, but they also gave him a domineering quality that showed itself in his relationship with Cassandra Perkins. Let's move into what was happening on December 1st, 2012, the date he tragically killed his girlfriend before killing himself. The first thing I looked at for this date was Jovan's progressions. This is a method of astrological forecasting that looks at life themes, not necessarily individual acute events, but themes over a period of time. In December of 2012, Jovan was in a period of negotiating contracts for love and money. He had Mercury, the planet of communication and of agreements, and Venus, the planet of love and resources, in the same degree in his progressed chart, which means he may have felt the need to forge some kind of agreement with his girlfriend that would enforce certain rules and expectations. He needed to come up with and agree to certain terms, and maybe he didn't feel ready for that. The conjunction between Mercury and Venus would have been exact in his progressions on July of 2013. Maybe Cassandra wanted to get married in a few months and he felt trapped. Or maybe it wasn't that intense. Maybe she just really wanted exclusivity in their relationship and he couldn't give it to her. Whatever agreement the two were passing back and forth, it's likely that Jovan wasn't ready to commit, as his actions clearly demonstrate. Looking at his transits, on the day he killed his girlfriend and himself, Mars was in 11 degrees Capricorn, Venus was in 11 degrees Scorpio, and Jupiter was retrograde in 11 degrees Gemini. These are his transits. This formed a web of exact aspects in the sky, which activated Jovan's 11 degree Leo Mars and his 10 degree Cancer Mercury. So relationship issues were activating his warrior energy through the Venus square to his Mars. Mars was causing a subconscious conflict with the idea of contracts. Family contract specifically, since it was in a quincunx with his Mercury in Cancer, which is the sign of family. And Jupiter was expanding on all of these issues through its sextile aspect with Jovan's natal Mars and its trine aspect with Venus in the transits. The whole transit formation was causing lots of conflict when it overlapped with Jovan's chart. And to top it all off, transiting Uranus was sitting right on top of his Aries North Node, hinting that there would be unexpected shifts in his manner of achieving his goals of self-actualization, shifts that ended in tragedy. So let's talk about premeditation for a minute. Was Jovan planning on killing his girlfriend? I would guess no. That's because Uranus is known for causing surprises. We can think about the North Node as Jovan's life path, and Uranus being on top of it at the time caused a freak event that dramatically shifted his way forward. Now, Uranus is a slow-moving planet, and it hangs out in one sign for a period of 7 years. So that means it's conjunct a particular point, like the North Node, for a very long time. But that's part of Uranus's image. You know it's going to come around and you know it's going to shake things up, but because it's so unpredictable, you can't know what exactly the shakeup will be or when exactly it will happen. And when it does happen, the energy of Uranus is fast. I actually tend to associate Uranus with the brain because of its electric energy. Its jolts are quick acting, like neurons that run on electricity inside the brain. If Jovan did have CTE, which it seems like he did, his brain may not have received a Uranus activation in the same way that a normally functioning brain would. The jolts of energy received could have been confused and could very well have made him turn destructive. In addition to all the planetary interactions that I've mentioned, there were a number of asteroid transits happening on the day that the tragedy took place. I'm not going to cover those today, but I will dive into them another time on my Patreon account, which is coming December 19th, 2020. Thank you for listening to another episode of Killer Astrology. Don't forget to leave a 5-star rating before you go. I'll be back with another episode next week. Until then, remember, people may lie, but the stars never do. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and follow the podcast on social media, the information for which you'll find in the episode description. Visit my website, killerastrologypodcast.com, for reference information for this episode. Schedule your own astrology reading with me by visiting killerastrologypodcast.com/services.